Okay, hello everyone. My name is Denisa Kostovicheva and I'm an associate professor in global politics at the European Institute that is hosting this lecture tonight. And I'm delighted to welcome Professor Oliver Richmond and to introduce his talk on international peace architecture, the EU, and the uncovering of counter peace. Oliver Richmond is professor of politics at the University of Manchester and the leading scholar of peace. And I was just chatting with Oliver previously and I was just saying it was really hard for me to preparing the introduction to select which books I should mention. So I was just decided to mention a few books that were pivotal in the way that they shape the way we discuss and think about peace. And these were A Post-Liberal Peace, his book published in 2011, a seminal work that questioned the normative nature of peace, how liberal it is, what are the actors and how do they behave and what are the outcomes. And two more recent volumes, Failed State Building and Peace Formation, another one, Peace Formation and Political Order, which relate the question of how peace is formed in relation to state building. I imagine you are quite intrigued to find out what counterpeace and the concept of counterpeace is, but I just thought I would just spend 2 minutes on sort of maybe putting this talk in context. And first I would like to say that I think it is really important to talk and think about peace. And you may say that this is really an obvious thing to say. However, some of our colleagues, scholars from Oxford, have done the analysis of all the scholarship in conflict and peace studies. And what they found out is that actually the study of peace is marginal. So when we talk about conflict and peace studies, most scholars actually study conflict. So there is this kind of infatuation with conflict and violence and much less research in comparison about peace. Secondly is that mostly scholars who study peace have rather a limited understanding of conflict. I think this is again surprising, but it comes out of this research. And then basically what we realize is that when we study conflict and peace, actually the study of conflict and peace, these are kind of completely siloed and separate sort of endeavors in academia. And thirdly, if you like, within peace studies and within the focus of on peace, scholars focused mostly on institutions and formal processes. And this is, we have lots of scholarship on peace agreements and conflict resolution and political parties, and very little understanding from that perspective on what's happening below peace agreements. And I think here I can just now come back and reintroduce Professor Richmond's work that has challenged robustly these three tides in the scholarship. He is a scholar of peace, but he studies peace in such a way that he brings in the understanding of conflict. And thirdly, he brings into view the complexity of peace at the everyday life, kind of looking at the fog of peace, right, which is not just a good thing. And he does that by trying to extrapolate what does this mean for policy making? How do we better than do things better? So this is why I'm really sort of looking forward to this treat of a talk and would like to ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Richmond. So, yeah, so you will speak for about 30 minutes okay. or so, and then we will open it up to questions.
Well, thanks, Denisa, for that really lovely introduction, which told me things about me that I perhaps hadn't even realised myself and my own work. Let me give this a bit of context. My journey really has been from thinking about, you know, I did classics to start with in undergraduate, and I looked at classical history, and it's all the history of warfare and power and the city-state and the good life and the best political order. Very sort of narrow systems, often of concentric circles. Often they're related to race and class and identity. And there are people who are kind of exiled from politics, and there are those who are included, and so on and so forth. And that stayed with me throughout all of my studies. And imagine my displeasure when I came to international relations and realised that so much of this was absent. And it's only 2,000 or 3,000 years later, and we've forgotten these really simple lessons about political order and the good life, and the roots and the drivers of conflict, and so on and so forth. So I always find myself being dragged back to that a little bit. The question of who is a citizen, what does citizenship mean, how does the polity constitute itself around a citizen, and how do you determine the good versus the not so good, and so on and so forth. I really felt that IR doesn't do very much of that. So when it came to talking about, you know, as I was studying 1960s peacekeeping and so on and so forth, we tended to talk about forms of intervention, very policy-driven, very prescriptive or very descriptive types of data, which left open those big political questions. You know, what is the good life? How does the state or the international or the political architecture interact with the citizen, with sustainability across generations, with justice, and these sorts of big questions? And it's very easy, I think, to get sucked into an intellectual framework and discourse where those things disappear from view. They're big questions, they're difficult questions. People have tried time and time again. They're sort of philosopher's stones, if you like, things that don't ever really turn out to be what you expect them to be. So I got myself sucked into a philosopher's stone, which is really, what is this question of peace, and how do we evaluate it, how do we create it, can it be actualized in practice through sensible policy and political structures and architectures? Can levers and tools be pulled and all the rest of it? So I travelled through that, and I got to looking at peacekeeping and mediation, negotiation, and then what we later came to call peace building, and then became, in some ways, more ambitiously termed state building. And behind all of this was lurking the idea that we're forming an international system. It's a system like we've never seen before. It's never been so dense, it's never been so networked, it's never been so complex, it's never been so powerful, it's never been so able to bring peace, to determine the answers to these difficult questions that have been asked by individuals and citizens all over the world. On the one hand, and on the other hand, it's never been so dangerous. The states, the international, the global political economy, and social forces, and so on and so forth. So as my sort of research developed and I started looking at this sort of question, which was influenced by a shift towards more post-colonial critical thinking in the 1990s, about how people caught up in conflict-affected societies would understand, on the one hand, the real impact of a peace agreement, let's take Dayton, and on the other hand, the practices of international actors and state actors and elites who engage with that agreement in positive or negative forms, whether it's the United Nations or the European Union or diplomats or leading states, great powers, or donors or civil society organisations. And when you start to dig into that a little bit, it becomes very textured and very complex and very unstable. There's nothing new there. This is a debate that goes back to at least Kant, if not far before, maybe even Plato to NATO. But what we're starting to see is the actualization of what I thought was a political architecture in which many of these practices had a place. So whether imperialism was a form of peace, whether extractive capitalism was a form of peace, contributed to peace, these were big debates in the 19th century. In the 20th century, the industrialized modern states, whether communist, socialist, or capitalist, or democratic in umbrella terms, these were big debates. And it's perplexing to me that we don't talk about these things very much anymore. And when we look at the policy literatures coming out of the EU, Brussels, or the UN in New York, or of the leading donors and the great powers, they don't touch those big issues. And that's despite the fact that we have this architecture, which has evolved and deepened and developed, which we used to call in the 1990s an alphabet soup, but I think has now become much more concrete in ways which I'm about to describe. So when I went to thinking about how communities, groups, individuals, the excluded, think about peace agreements and peacekeeping and peace building in those post-war experiences from the 1950s through the 1960s, looking at the kinds of limited data we had access to, which is growing now, of course, I started to wonder what it means for the reconstruction of the international. And I started to have a look around different literatures, interdisciplinary literatures. Now, this is, again, not a new motif. The international has constantly been reconstructed. And the 20th century international, the one that came out of the post-war world, was perhaps the most complex, in many ways convoluted, certainly the most far-reaching that we've ever seen. And a lot of it was founded on a sort of normative justification that it was aimed at building peace. So the question for me was, how has this peace architecture developed? I started looking at archaeology, in actual fact, and there is this kind of strand of archaeology, trying to be interdisciplinary, which is the kind of one of the motifs of current research. There is, I mean, it makes everything very superficial, but it also brings interesting stimuli to the discussion. So there is this sort of area called disaster archaeology, and some of you will know a writer perhaps called Jerry Diamond, who wrote all this stuff about the collapse of ancient civilizations and what it means for modern civilizations. And it's a lot of it's scaremongering, and a lot of it seems to be hard to evidence and so on. But before that, there was quite an important book by someone called Joseph Tainter, who has reemerged again in the 1980s, sort of American social science-y archaeologist, who started to look at ancient civilizations and the political agreements that they created as they developed and evolved, and what stimulated their collapse, and what they did about it. And he came up with a checklist of elements for what created an architecture which stabilized a polity, and for when the warning signs were the red, the amber and the red warning signs were. It's very similar to the state building debates of the 2000s, where we started to say, you know, this would be a failing state because there were no public services, because it was insecure, because there was false news circulating, because there was propaganda. It started to sound a bit like Brexit, in actual fact. So we start to see the replaying of a scaled-up discussion across the disciplines about what makes a polity viable and how it reinvents itself. One of the big things that Tainter argued was necessary for ancient civilizations to survive was something quite amorphous, questions of legitimacy, but legitimacy was related to very material factors, the provision of services, resources, and in particular, energy and technology. So anyway, this got me thinking about architectures and how a lot of what we study in international relations is about whether political architectures, social systems, economic systems, the state system, the liberal international architecture, the UN system, the donor system, the transnational framework, whether these things are able to deal with the problems of the day. So I've started to try and unpack that a little bit, that architecture. And this is what I'm suggesting could be of interest to those of us who are interested in the development of peace. And almost as an aside, the place of the EU and its attempts to deal with its own conflicts within and around its border regions, and also more recently further afield in places like Mali and DRC and all the rest of it. So I'd like to unpack this architecture of the last 150 years or so, which has built up as a response to the fragility of politics, the tendency for the prescriptive, the localization of political debates and activities, to not be able to address those big political questions. I think we've kind of built about six layers over the last 100 or so years of this political architecture. Every layer has followed a major systemic conflict, direct, structural, or cultural, or economic. So it's always kind of reactive. It's always developed after conflict, after war, and it's always defined the peace for a time. And it actually maps on, in some ways, quite nicely to the development of IR theory across the great debates. I know it's not fashionable to talk about great debates in IR theory anymore. We have to kind of take other positionalities and other journeys for IR theory. But in actual fact, these architectures do follow a little bit in this, because it's also, if you like, about the development of political power in international relations. So this is an architecture of layers, of six different layers. It's like a palimpsest. You could look down on it, look down through it over the last 150 years or so, and you can see each layer is still extant, it's still operating, but often, and this is something that one of these disaster archaeologists, particularly Joseph Tainter, pointed out in his early work on these ancient civilizations that collapsed, often nobody really is around anymore who understands why they exist, what they do, and how to operate them. So they have this sort of intergenerational life, which is more of an echo, if you like, than an active capacity. These stages are responses to each other. They entangle each other. They're also inherently unstable. They're not in a harmonious relationship with each other. They're in tension with each other. So the stages of the current international architecture that we have today, which I think is much broader than the use, let's say, that the UN Secretariat make of the term peacebuilding architecture, are, if you like, in a relationship with each other which is almost terminal. This is not a happy relationship. It's more like Jenga. Do you remember that kids' game where you pile up the pieces of wood on each other and then you pull one out at the bottom and the whole thing might collapse or might not? So the first stage is obviously the stage which developed out of the kind of geopolitical and imperial era. So high imperialism in the 19th century only really worked because there was a balancing mechanism. Okay, it was exclusive, it authorized certain types of politics and a certain hierarchy, and it couldn't go all the way, because if it did, there would be a total war. That was the experience of the 20th century. So the kind of balancing mechanisms, we call it quaintly in international relations and realist theory, the balance of power, as if there was this homeostatic balance that kind of God or the divine is operating in the favour of the European colonial powers, or as if there were a European power capable of operating that balance. That balance itself is what needs to be maintained. That's what maintains order, that's what provides and distributes resources, and creates some very limited semblance of peace. And again, if you go back to the 1950s, 1960s discussion of this in the peace and conflict studies literature, they talked about this as a negative peace. I mean, I think it's very quaint to talk about the balance of power in the context of imperialism and the rapid industrialization of the westernized state and its dissemination across the world in the 20th century in that way. It's a very Eurocentric perspective. So the first layer of this international peace architecture, which is foundational, which is geopolitical and geoeconomic, is in itself inherently unstable. I don't want to narrate this in too much detail, but you know, obviously the second layer is a response to the question, well, what do you do about civil war and imperial conflict? And the two answers to that question, which come to us through the Enlightenment debates in political theory, are you design constitutional orders in some republican and liberal sense. This is, if you like, Kant speaking to us down the ages. And you start to build an international system, an international architecture, to moderate the anarchy above the civil, above the state. So stage two is the liberal peace framework, and it's in its very beginnings. So we start to see this, you know, balanced over the geopolitical. It's not that it resolved the geopolitical issues of the 19th century. Didn't resolve the problem of boundaries, not being contiguous with human populations and their identities. It didn't solve the problems of distribution of resources across the international. But it designed a constitutional and international order that was just enough, but without threatening the geopolitical structures to the extent that they would topple that second layer. So we have this second layer in the palimpsest building up. You can see both operating. They're in this tense relationship with each other. And this liberal constitutional order and the beginnings of the liberal international system, both of trade, of institutions, and of law, by the beginnings of the 20th century, were just enough just enough to neutralize the flailing nature of geopolitics, the great power race for imperial territories, for resources, and to control each other. So in a way, that's sort of a success story, and you can see the beginnings of a broader architecture emerging there, because this stage two becomes a platform for a stage three. So you can see, in a sense, that this is almost an evolutionary process. It's kind of odd for a critical theorist to be talking about this, but anyway, that's what happens next. So what we have next, then, is a sort of Marxist, structuralist challenge to the claim that we see being made in the 20th century, after World War I, after World War II, that this liberal political order that's emerging itself has revised how we understand peace. So we've gone from a negative peace in Lair 1. This is a peace with an awful lot of violence, but at least the violence is contained in certain areas with cordons sanitaires and with imperial forces positioned and with demonstrations of symbolic power and all the rest of it, to a situation where we're starting to expect certain rights in a constitutional framework, and we're starting to organise ourselves in an international system, and we're starting to build a system of international law. And that's kind of grabbed onto geopolitics. And that's foundational in many ways for, I think, modern international relations and how we think about peace today. In quite a few ways, we haven't really moved beyond that, but that's absolutely crucial, I think, for how Europe begins to deal with its wars, its imperial, its colonial, and its industrial wars in the 20th century. This is the thing that they grab onto, if you like. But, of course, under duress and coercion, this is not about independent agency building a new system. So stage three starts to make the hypothesis that if we can have those rights and those laws, well, there's a whole group of people in the international who are being excluded, and that's labour. So we're starting to see, and what's important about this is the phenomenon of the expansion of rights. So it's not about the policing and patrolling of rights by the state, the Leviathan, if you like, whether it's a Hobbesian or kind of Rousseauian version of the Leviathan. It's about using it as a platform to expand rights. This makes the architecture, at its third layer, more unstable. Because what we're actually seeing is a greater challenge to layer one, to the geopolitical layer, and also something of a challenge to the arguments that the liberal peace framework is a perfected form of politics that sees fruitfully the journey from Plato all the way through Aristotle and across to Augustine, on to Kant and beyond, as being a journey which leads us to the idea that democratic peace, liberal forms of democracy and all the rest of it are where the game is. So peace itself is supposed to rest at that point. Basic human rights, democracy, a rule of law, and so on. That becomes the mantra of the 1990s. That's the 1990s speaking in a kind of stage two voice. But stage three, raises the question, well, what about if there are other ways of thinking about rights? And you see that much of the latter part of the 20th century is a contest over those rights. How do we think about economic, cultural, and social rights? Well, what do we think of when we look at ECOSOC, as opposed to the Security Council or the General Assembly? So you can see that, in a sense, what's happening here is a tussle between these stages two and three over who gets to define the parameters of rights in the international, the reach of rights, but also the enforcement of rights. I think what's more important, and particularly for those of us coming into modern and contemporary international relations thinking, is stage four. And it's stage four where we start to see some of the contradictions in this thinking. So we're stacking now onto stage three, a new layer, which tries to respond to some of the limitations of stage three, which says that these are not just rights that are defined by the ownership of capital, the means of production, and solidarity across states, and so on and so forth. But these are rights which are much more broadly defined. So by stage four, and we start to see this developing in the UN General Assembly and the treaty system, and in the EU, a discussion about, well, what other rights are out there? Once you start to look at this international architecture and you start to see gaps and you start to make the claim that individuals, not states or organisations, are able to authorise rights claims, then there's a whole series of new rights that are missing in that system. So it's with that stage four that we start to get a sense of what peace building came to be about, what it came to include. Again, the challenge to power, and in particular the foundational power of geopolitics in stage one, is amplified in stage four. We start to see a discussion of rights in and between different types of groups, different understandings of identity beyond nation-state forms of identity, national, ethnic, religious, linguistic, and so on. We began to see questions of gender rights, and of course we began to see just the beginnings of a debate about the environment and the place of, if you like, nature, and the problem of the separations between nature and the human and society and so on in that debate. So by that stage, stage four, which sets the scenes for many of the peace processes which the EU becomes involved in the 1990s and beyond, we start to see a rescripting of a peace agreement, of a peace treaty, of peacekeeping, of mediation, and what they're supposed to do. In stage one, it was about helping great power elites balance their interests, maintaining them, right? So maintaining their positions, but making sure that there could be a compromise or a balancing mechanism which was non-threatening to their power positions, and trying to negate or pacify alternative challenges. In stage two, we began to get involved in the dirty work of the redesign of the polity and of the building up of a broader international system. Stage three threw in the curveball, which is that we need to go back to very basic questions about who owns the resources and how they're distributed, on what basis. Are they distributed according to the existing hierarchy of empires and states, or are they distributed according to your status as a member of the labour force or the workforce? Stage four expands that even further. So the challenge of thinking about peace at this point, and it's sort of encapsulated in the way, in particular in sort of US social science circles, the critique of critical theory was often, well, you're just inculcating mission creep. You know, something like responsibility to protect, for example, or the way in which the EU is deploying integration association agreements are creating impossibly broad terrains for peace to be crafted around. So as we expand the agenda, we expand the hierarchy, every step so far makes it more complex, it consumes far more energy, it needs far more expertise. In other words, it's sort of following the track that disaster archaeologists claim happens when previous historical civilizations have failed. They've got too big to manage, nobody remembers why, nobody wants to invest in them anymore, their legitimacy begins to fail, they become moribund, nobody remembers what they were there for, until when they collapse, all the same issues push up again. So stage four gives us this enormous expansion of rights. Hannah Arendt, you know, kind of in a sense foresaw this, I think, in her important work on many different levels. Stage five was a retraction in this architecture. This is a stage that many of us, I think, you know, kind of most familiar with today. This is the state-building paradigm of the 2000s. So whereas we went from an attempt in the 1990s, for example, in Bosnia, to build a peace agreement with the addendum of a constitutional order, we would go then later on in the late 1990s to attempts to build a peace agreement that fashioned the state in entirety, but using, let's say, consensus building, legitimacy, but most importantly, using expert knowledge from the international community, the Peace Building Commission as it came into being. By the time we get to stage five in this Topoli architecture, there is a kind of retraction from the implications of this. You know, rights can't keep expanding, the architecture is getting too unstable, its different layers are becoming too challenging, they're destabilizing each other. So where do we go with that? And in some senses, you had two choices. One was to go back to some kind of neo-imperialism, probably with the US, at its center. And the other is to go back to the state. I think it's there that we start to see again, you know, the idea that the nation state is the ultimate arbiter of rights and prosperity and the good life for its communities, and the boundaries and so on that come with that come back into play. So this is what this helps us understand why what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan in the 2000s, and why what hasn't happened in Syria are, if you like, the most contemporary cases. If you can't anchor peace to this expansion of rights, which has very much been driven by a perspective of our collective wisdom, if you like, about how to design the state and the international state-society relations and beyond, then you're only really left with a very reductionist approach to building peace. And that means in stage five, peace is connected mainly to state security and global capital, which is sort of ludicrous because these are the two contradictory forces that stages two and stages three were fighting over back in the early industrial period of thinking about peace. So what we have by stage five is a very unstable architecture. And it was a bit unfortunate in a way that the kind of the high time for EU peace building, this is when the EU sort of shifted, if you like, from the idea that it was a subcontractor of UN peacekeeping and peace building, a contributor to its peacekeeping and peacebuilding roads and also its development role, into being a more autonomous actor in the international, doing more and better than the UN could do after Rwanda and after Bosnia, taking over the mantle in Bosnia and Kosovo, getting involved in its own missions in Mali and Central African Republic and so on and so forth. This was the very time when the framework for peace, the international peace architecture itself, was probably its most unstable. And we were sort of trying to deal with these complex questions about how do you manage expectations? This is one of the big debates about the sort of state-building era. Managing expectations, making sure there's no political project, importing just enough knowledge not to create local resistance, maintaining the framework of the state, rebuilding the state as a closed, not an open architecture. And if you like, pulling back the overall international architecture because it's been too heavily diluted. And I think that's where the UN almost enters the fray. Too late, if you like. This is where the EU enters the fray. Too late, and the UN has almost already given up on that project at that point. So the question then is, well, where are we now? What happens? Stage five, you know, stage five is the kind of Syrian case. You can no longer do intervention because you don't know who you're working with. There's no great power consensus. There's no model for the redesign of the state. There's no coercive capacity to gain access to redesign the state. And the internationals who are not necessarily involved in the great power game but would like to make a contribution don't really know what levers to pull. They've almost forgotten about the liberal peace experience of the 20th century. So the question for us really, and this is sort of bringing things to a close, is what would stage six look like in this international architecture? Now, I think that just to take a shortcut here, you would look at something like the UN's Sustaining Peace Agenda, which is, you know, itself drawn from the Sustainable Development Agenda, which tries to deal with a lot of the issues that were raised in the various discussions and critiques between these different layers of the architecture over the last 100 and 150 years. Also tries to draw in a lot of the critical research and experience that we've had over that period, and shift the debate about peace from great power balance, from the perfection of the design of the state, from interventionary practices which emerge in stage four, stage five, and to some degree now, more to questions about what type of justice we'll be engaged with if we were to have a peace agreement. So this would re-script how we think about peace agreements, how we think about tools which are used for peace building and development. And I think that's sort of underlying this question. Debates about intergenerational sustainability, bringing in nature, looking at power relations as things which are not just eternal and need to be placated, but also could drive peace in those contexts. Thinking about its broader nesting in the international system, taking away the divisive bounding capacity of the state and also the regional architecture. Flipping the UN Health Development Index on its head, and rather than seeing it as a race to the top, seeing it as an index of inequalities and fragility and indicators of where the pressure points are for conflict in those states as a tool to be used in order to try and do something about it. That's one possibility for stage six. But I think as ever, what you can see is that the international peace architecture has been bifurcated. It's not a progressive evolution. It steps forward, it steps back, it's complex. There's no single design behind it. There's no great plan behind it. It's reactive, it's slow. It's sort of ethnographic in many ways, because what it's doing is it's building in a social response to war and conflict with the knowledge of the last war. It's always fighting that last war. And the most, I think, disturbing thing that I think about debates that are emerging, at least in the policy terrain, and this is happening in the EU and the UN and the donor circles, and also to some degree in the NGO global civil society networks too, is a shift towards thinking about new technologies. How do we stable, and this is what Joseph Tainter, this disaster archaeologist, starts with in a way, in his work on why civilizations collapse. They collapse because they don't find a new power source, they don't find new technology. It's a very neoliberal sort of ideology in some ways. So what seems to be of most interest when you go to DPKO in New York, or when you go to Brussels and talk to people about, you know, peace building, what do they don't even know what it really means, I think, these days. But what's of most interest is the way in which we bring together data, processing, surveillance, and new technologies to rethink the state and its relationship with society and the international. And there's the beginnings of a new form of governmentality here. This is not the human face-to-face governmentality of liberalism. It's not the geopolitical governmentality of elite geopolitics in stage one. It's a governmentality in which one manages expectations, one manages human populations from a great distance without dealing with any kind of emancipatory claims about peace or justice. In some ways, you probably look at recent discussions that have been circling around the long-standing failed peace process in Palestine, over the Middle East, particularly in Palestine, which is this question of what's the point of peace? We don't recognise peace. What we want is justice. So what they're saying at the stage six point, I think, is either we go down the global justice path, and that's where the UN agenda is pushing and where the EU agenda may be pushing, but it's less clear, I think, even if you look at the global strategy. Or you go down this agenda of using these new technologies and new capacities to find more subtle ways of governing without peace. In other words, reinventing and extending the geopolitics of stage one. And that's a very simple answer to the problem of how do you stabilize the international peace architecture. You stabilize it by making sure its foundations are stable. The rest of it doesn't matter. Okay, now I think from a critical perspective, that's not really acceptable. Probably isn't sustainable. Okay? But from a governmental perspective, when you're talking about governing this world, as Mark Mazower sort of famously posited, it begins to make sense from that kind of bird's eye perspective. So the reinvention of stage one, the reinvention of geopolitics for a sort of digital era. Now that to me is counter-revolutionary. Right? That to me is about rolling back the rights that we've seen that have grown with social movements, as we saw them in the late 19th century, moving through gender and voting rights, disarmament, labour rights, and so on and so forth, to the design of the state to guarantee those rights, the often claimed realist position that you need a state to guarantee rights, therefore you need a state, which has become a tautology. It's about dismantling an international architecture which people don't remember why it exists or think it's now defunct. The EU, the UN, who needs these things? International law, well, that was, we needed that post-war, but now do we need it? So there's a very strong sense that you can do these things in different ways. You can conduct human politics in different ways, and therefore we can have what you could call a digital peace. It's counter-revolutionary, it's a counterpiece, and it's about unpacking many of the systems that are built up over time, over a long period of time. So the counterpiece, just to give you a sort of short perspective on what I'm thinking about here, follows on from thinking about counterinsurgency connected to imperialism in the high 19th century, or from counter-revolution connected to the several hundred years history of revolutions that we've had for rights. And you can see the close relationship between revolutionary and counter-revolutionary thinking and practice in the development of the modern state, as well as in the development of rights in the international system. And what I've been thinking about, and this is sort of speculative, and I'm just putting it out there, but you can throw it away if you don't like it, but what I'm thinking about is if you break down the international peace architecture into its constituent parts, and rather than seeing it as a separate attempt to deal with a previous systemic form of conflict, geopolitical, imperial, economic, ideological, ethnic, or whatever it might have been, instead you see that these are integrally related to each other, and that there is always a counter framework developing as this positive framework is also emerging. So where you get peacekeeping emerging as a result of that layer two, but extended into layer four, you also get counter peacekeeping. Think about the case of Cyprus, one that we've been following for far too long. Peacekeeping was great in Cyprus, wasn't it? We went in 1964, we stopped the fighting, it stopped the Cold War from igniting, it stopped Greece and Turkey from having a war and all the rest of it. But what it also did was it froze the status quo. It allowed the power relations to remain as they were in 1964. And they've developed incrementally, by the way. They have not necessarily just stuck it at that point. It's also allowed elements of the peace to develop. There's something subversive going on here. Peacekeeping is very closely related to debates about how one builds a new constitutional order for Cyprus and in the region, right? But it's also very closely related to the failure to do so. If you think about mediation, think about Kissinger's take on mediation in the Middle East, same thing. He's practicing mediation, but is it really counter-mediation? Because think about his mediation between Egypt and Israel. He left out the Palestinians. I mean, that's really quite problematic. And yet we constantly cite it as a case of successful mediation. But it's not, it's counter-mediation. We're still living with the consequences. Again, if you think about peace building, retrospectively, we started to call the role of the UN, the OSCE, the EU, and so on in Bosnia, peace building. Initially, we called it peacekeeping. We dealt with political problems of recognition. We talked about diplomacy. We talked about maybe development. We talked about rebuilding a post-socialist space. Eventually, it became peace building. And with the very process of peace building, with the dynamics of peace building, so think about the way in which the EU has used integration and association to hold back carrots, I mean, to use the carrot as a stick in Bosnia, it's actually, in a way, it's opposed to the peace. It's opposed to the claims that would be made on the ground if you ask people what they wanted: security, prosperity, equality, maybe justice. So the more you dig into this, the more you start to see that what I've called here the international peace architecture is heavily implicated in its own opposition, in a counter-architecture. It's not just balanced on top in an evolutionary sense, but it's also tightly bound and entwined with itself. So unpacking that, and that's something that the 20th century gave us, the idea that we could have regional architectures, regional institutions, security organizations, the UN system, and so on and so forth. That would be ways in which those things would be dealt with. And what we would do is we would see them in constructive and positive ways in stage six. And yet when you go and talk about what's happening in the UN and so on right now to deal with the problems of peacekeeping, it's actually about the other part of stage six. It's about the digital governmentality part of stage six, which is not political. There's no political project. It's not engaged with questions of justice. It's dealing with efficacy, it's dealing with geopolitics, it's dealing with global capital. So is there any wonder that the peace agreements, take Colombia, of the last 10 years, have tended to come to a full stop before they even got going. Now for me, you know, this is obviously it's very problematic. The international peace architecture is morphing into a counter-peace architecture, and you can see how its different actors, from civil society upwards, are being swept along with that process. In a sense, they're being governed. They're being governed into relinquishing any sense of the political and emancipatory objectives of a reformed political order. Okay, perhaps I should stop there. I could go on, but I won't.
Just as I was poised to hear more. Thank you very much. Okay, so shall we now take questions? We have a mic. So shall we take three questions at a time? Okay, so first question there.
Hi, my name is Beanie. I'm studying international relations at King's College. And thank you for being here today to talk to us. And my question is about solidarity, and it comes from like kind of realist perspective. So the layers that you just explained us sounds very good from the liberal perspective, but like the realist in me is asking how in this capitalistic world where states are driven by self-interest and resources, we can have this certain level of solidarity that is, in my opinion, required for this authentic peace building that comes from the perspective of actually laying the solid foundations that you just explained for the peace, instead of doing R2P humanitarian intervention from like economic benefit and other kind of like hidden agendas behind that. Do you understand what I mean?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to respond.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Should we do a question there and then the first question here? Oops.
Good evening. Thank you for the presentation. My name is Arturo Montejo. I'm from Colombia, currently working in the Health Policy Department as a research assistant. And my question is related with the peace implementation because, well, we have a very good peace agreement in the architecture, but the implementation is not working now. Perhaps during the previous government, President Santos' government, and in the current government, the implementation is like not a priority. We are not, especially the ex-member of the previous guerrilla, they are waiting for the support of the state, but the state is not, they are not like looking for their welfare. So how could we like civil society just to contribute or what is your suggestion in order to implement this peace agreement, because it's not working currently?
I'll have the third question here, and we'll do the next round. Yeah?
Thank you very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I was liaison officer for an EU mission in Bosnia to EU4, and I then worked with the state security service in Ukraine for another EU mission. Neither the mission was exactly the Entebbe raid. Gross strategic illiteracy, incompetence, and not a small amount of corruption. My question is, how as the what you describe as the EU generically, but the central EU bodies and the member states working together and with the UK, regardless of what happens to Brexit, because President Macron recognises the need, how are they adjusting, particularly the central bodies, which are essentially civilian bodies who are not particularly comfortable with policemen, dislike soldiers, to the rise of China and Russia resurgence, and particularly as a case study, you did mention the EU military mission in the Central African Republic. The outgoing and incoming heads of that mission have been reported recently as what effectively amounts to tearing their hair out about the problem of Wagner. How have the European Union central bodies reacted to Wagnerism? Because Wagner didn't turn up a few months ago or last year. They've been around for donkey's years. And I'm illustrating. I had a conversation with the EU political advisor in Moldova. He was not aware that Kiev had been under German occupation during the Second World War. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So going back to your solidarity question, I mean, you know, obviously I've been really absolutely fascinated in looking at the literature on peace studies, social mobilization, civil society, transnational civil society, global civil society, all those things, which in their, you know, non-violent resistance, so on, in all of their various ways, have tried to find ways of exercising leverage. And we've tended from an outside perspective to see these kind of emancipatory movements that have some sort of potentially mystical agency that we'd like to know more about, but we perhaps shouldn't expose it, and so on, and so forth. And you know, without question, if you look at the growth of the architecture, much of the institutionalization, the legalization of that architecture, as well as the security moves, have come about because there has been enormous social pressure at different places and different times. But it's no fine art, I don't think. And the blunt instruments you refer to, which is, you know, which is realist geopolitical other end of the spectrum, also not fine art, has also had, if you like, the capacity to push back very powerfully, sometimes not, but sometimes it has and does. So what we find is that this architecture is sort of locked into this unstable kind of relationship between these different layers. And I'm not saying that one is greater than the other, and that just because geopolitics is foundational, that it will always come back. But I think what we can see, if I'm right, in the evolution of the architecture, that these kind of social moves to think about emancipation and justice and to find methods of tweaking, to burst out of the state system, to build NGO networks and regional architectures and global architectures and legal frameworks and to mobilise. These are, in a way, reactive, and they need to be constitutionalised. This is at least what we've seen so far. And is that going to be the case with this digital moment that we're seeing, where everything has gone into the kind of the ether, into the atmosphere? I'm not sure whether solidarity works in the digital world. I mean, there's something very human and face-to-face and analogue about how we thought about solidarity when we're looking at stages two. We're thinking about solidarity over voting rights, over questions of enfranchisement, over what it is to be human, over gender. Stage three, over labour rights. I mean, all that stuff was very low-tech. And it involved an awful lot of social mobilisation and a lot of debates, struggle, the distillation of political agendas. And it only worked if it had a sense of politics. That is the distribution of scarce resources and how one locks that in various ways. That creates a social balance, which one could call peace with justice. Now, I don't think that we're anywhere near that now. You know, if you look at the Sustaining Peace Agenda, if you look at the EU's global strategy, it's very textual. You know, it's hard to find many communities out of civil society or out of the policy community who will speak in this way. And in fact, you know, if you look at what seems to motivate young people in this country, who would have been the revolutionaries and the radicals of previous times, it's the environment. And it's issues which are not necessarily on that institutional agenda. If you talk to them about peace agreements and peacekeeping, you know, that's a lost world of the 1950s and 1960s, and there are a few in the 2000s, and I heard about one in 2014. But that's about it. You know, the political agenda has moved, and I don't see that as manufactured any kind of emancipation discourse. It's not reshaping the state. In other words, it's leaving the centres of power, the power structures, alone. So all we have is this kind of slightly autonomous architecture keeping things in check at the moment, which is what checks and balances are supposed to do. But it also needs to be fed. And it doesn't seem to be being fed. So you have this kind of the sustaining peace agenda, the sustainable development goals. There should be a massive concentration of efforts around it. There should be an enormous amount of energy around it, but it seems to be discursive, mainly. So there's an implementation gap. And incidentally, in a couple of EU research projects that I've had on different cases, comparing different cases where the EU's been doing peacekeeping, peacebuilding, crisis management, and diplomacy, we tend to see, surprise, surprise, that's a massive gap between the policies on the table written into the agreements and the actual practices, as I think you also referred to, and Arturo, as you referred to in the Colombia case. Although I think that's, well, it's a pro-related reason, but it's down to the fact that we've somehow written out economic determinism from how we understand politics today. I mean, it seems to be something which is implausible to talk about the possibility of using politics to bring about economic, social, cultural justice. To talk about ECOSOC, it's almost a dead letter. I mean, these sorts of things have been written out in modern politics, so is it even politics? If it's not in a peace agreement to talk about the nature of an economic system, to talk about economic redistribution, along with the expansion of rights, is it even a peace agreement? Would hazard a guess that my answer would be no, right? Although it is written into international law, it is a treaty, and therefore it carries this weight, but it's, as Tainter and the disaster archaeologists are saying about what you see at the end of civilizations, it doesn't carry material weight. And that, I think, is a significant problem. It's somehow detached from our political interests, from our debates about emancipation and justice. It doesn't carry along local populations. It doesn't carry along international political will anymore. I mean, the UN, to some degree, certain parts of the UN, is starting to look a bit like the League of Nations. We have to face up to that and do something about it. This interdisciplinary kind of architecture that I've sketched for you will tumble. Okay, have I?
Okay, we had a question here. Mary?
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. And secondly, well, I'm a master's student here doing IR. And I was wondering, when you were talking about the lawyer in the 1990s, how do you think that
I was talking about the 1990s.
Oh, yeah, when you were talking about the lawyer in the 1990s, where do you think the creation of a separate European security defense identity falls in here, and then the consequent emergence of European security and defense policy as like separate from NATO? Where do you think that actually comes here in place?
I mean, I have to say, and you know, just after that time, I was engaged in a research project which was looking at the emerging gap between the way in which the EU was positioning itself in, particularly in Bosnia, but also in Kosovo in the Middle East, and its capacity to pull the material levers of power that would make those sorts of things happen. And even back then, and I think, Eleanor, you might have been involved in that too, but even back then we were discussing very clearly how this was sort of a documentary fiction. So this was playing the game of international law, building up a treaty base, but it wasn't about creating the material capacity for implementation. So this is why you get counterpiece built into the peace agreement. For example, in Bosnia, what we see is a use of... So the kind of peace process, in a way, the implementation is shifted onto the shoulders of the European Union at some point, but the European Union says, our conditionalities, according to our policies, which are discursive, mean that we can't act. It's on your shoulders. And I think that's problematic, because what it does is it dilutes, it undermines even further the positionality of somebody in a conflict-affected society who suffered war, who suffers from power relations, who hasn't been able to attain rights, who doesn't have material resources to draw on, and yet is still mobilizing. So it becomes a bit of theatre, in a way. Now, that's not to say that it discursively shouldn't be transferred into something more actionable. But where's that going to come from? And I think the gentleman before referred to that in his comments too. I mean, where... So what we have is a system of creating peace agreements and peace building and doing peace agreement, which only does, let's say, 10% of what it says on the tin. And so it's storing up, or it's pacifying, or it's placating, or it's just therapy for those of us back home.
Amen to that.
Right, so we end up in a situation now where we have built an architecture, we've invested blood, steel, and wisdom in this architecture over many hundreds of years, right? And we're drawing more and more, it's broadening, it's the most complex thing, it's the most complex political organization we've ever seen in human history, right? It's gone southern, it's gone east-west, and yet, much of its reach is very superficial, it's very tenuous. There's something about, and so you can also look at debates about state formation here too. Isn't the state the same? I mean, stateness, those of you who are doing IR, you know, will know that this is a concept which sort of describes the virtuality of the state in many ways. We take it as if it were a material thing, but in many ways, we're not just talking about the misallocation of resources and power, the misuse of wisdom. We're talking about a complete failure, a complete lack of capacity. So we get more and more ambitious. It's one of the things that disaster archaeologists warn about. You get very, very ambitious, and then you overextend yourself. And the only way you can solve the problem is a new technology or a new energy source. I mean, okay, you've heard that mantra, but that's kind of where we are now. What revitalizes the UN? What revitalizes the EU? What makes, we were talking about the BRICS 10 years ago, a new entrance into this system? What makes them included? What makes those people who have been subject to peace agreements in the post-colonial period, from DRC to Cyprus to Bosnia, Kosovo, onwards to Timor and Colombia and all the rest of it, what makes them feel like this was theirs, that it works, they own it, and they can build on it? In the same way as that this architecture, very Eurocentric construction, works for a while for us in Europe. These are big questions. Why isn't IR answering them?
Okay, Professor Mary Calder.
Gosh, well, I'm still not sure I completely understand what you're saying, but it's very interesting. And, you know, I agree with you about the complexity of the international peace architecture, though I wonder, I mean, it's the complexity of global architecture in general, not just the peace architecture, seems to me. I mean, and it's linked to digitalization in a way, because what we've seen is just an enormous growth of international institutions, international regulations that are much denser and thicker than ever before. So anyway, there I'm in agreement. I just had a couple of questions. First of all, I'm rather intrigued by this idea of counterpeace. But you use it in quite different ways. I mean, on the one hand, there's definitely a problem with all peace agreements, and the big problem is that the people who participate in the peace agreements are the warring parties who are expected to implement peace when they're actually interested in war. And maybe we could call that counterpeace. I've been thinking you shouldn't call peace agreements peace agreements. They're a sort of political framework created by the international community. But then you have this other idea, which I think is really intriguing, about digitalization and governmentality. And I've been kind of really worrying about, but I'm trying to think, what does it actually mean in practice? I mean, are you talking about drones and that kind of thing and the real use of technology to take out horrible people? Or are you thinking more of surveillance and control? I mean, I've been off trying to understand what China's up to. China's now the biggest contributor to peacekeeping. It's the biggest contributor to the African peace and security architecture. So what, I went to China and they seem to think, they really like the concept of human security, which was alarming me. And it seemed to mean peacekeeping plus infrastructure. So it's a kind of new repressive sort of peace that provides stability for infrastructure but doesn't provide any of the things we would think contribute to peace. So that was one question. And then the other issue, sorry, I'm going on a bit long, was really about social struggles and thinking about what you were saying in response to the last question. Because when I think about it, and you too, I mean, we were peace activists in the Cold War period, and I think that enormously helped shape the international peace-building architecture. And the new generations of activists, very few are peace activists. But I do think there are activists. I don't agree with you, they aren't. I mean, they're concerned about social justice and ecology. And I feel our big mistake was that we were totally preoccupied with peace and took social justice for granted. And that allowed the neoliberals to take over. But I now think there really is a serious thinking about ecology and social justice and creating and contributing towards that, particularly in relation to the EU. And the problem is, why doesn't it relate to peace? I mean, why is it, I'm constantly puzzled, why is there not solidarity with Syria, you know, the way there was with Bosnia? Why does nobody push the UN and the EU to do stuff on Syria? Now there's about to be a horrible peace agreement in Afghanistan between the US and Taliban. You know, why aren't we all absolutely outraged about what's happening, what could happen? All those people who died supposedly peacekeeping, and then we hand back the country to the Taliban. You know, so there's so many issues like that. There's the Lebanon protests, the Iraq protests, the Sudan protests, but they don't seem to create the same solidarity as Bosnia did.
If I could, you know, just respond a little bit. I mean,
sorry, I went on rather a lot.
No, but it's good. But okay. I mean, it's making me think. But I think it's very difficult to connect how we think about peace now to any emancipatory political project. So, you know, ideology is dead. Neoliberalism has taken over everything. There's no great power kind of impetus to push human rights. So a lot of the tick boxes have been distorted or diluted. So what would you build a peace agreement around? A peace agreement in Syria will be around great power interests and centralization of power.
Yeah, but you wouldn't build a peace agreement. You create some...
I mean, the point is, you know, if you had a real solidarity movement with Syrian civil society... You'd be arguing for quite different things.
Exactly,
you'd be pushing for an EU presence to protect local ceasefires. You'd be, you know, you'd be arguing for dealing with all the money launderers and the criminals who are all making money in London. You know, and there are people saying all those things, but they're not the basis of a mass movement.
So... But don't you think that the part of the problem is that we don't have a leadership which they can jump off? I mean, there's been no space opened for this. So when you look at those big moments where these, you know, in my terms, those different layers came into being, all of a sudden the door opened. Often the door had opened because there'd been something like the Syrian war. It was terrible and it had to stop, you know, or there had been some realization of a ludicrous system of oppression and it had to stop. And it became politically expedient. And these social movements were allowed to coalesce about it. So it became revolutionary. But what I think is different now is after that 20 or 30 years where we had human rights to jump off and the idea of democracy to jump off and perhaps some faint idea that development, okay, it's not a welfare state, but we'd have development. You know, there'd be something, it's not economic equality, but there'd be political equality, you know, this kind of thing. So there was some sense that you could coalesce around this and you could build on it. But as time has gone on, what do we see being built? I mean, in some senses, if you look at Bosnia, people are claiming that rights are regressing. And that's not uncommon. In other places, people are saying that, you know, long-held dear customs are being trampled on by economic and social practices that have been brought in by outsiders. That's just reducing the legitimacy. And there's no political project as yet that has sufficient leverage behind it to challenge those sorts of positions. So on the one hand, you have the counterpiece actors, who I think promoting this kind of stuff. I mean, they don't want the EU to have a coherent material strategy for peace building and development, stabilisation and association. I mean, they want to make these things empty vessels. The UN has to a large degree been made the empty vessel. The moment the UN Peace Building Commission was founded, it was given the most marginal of cases to deal with. You know, all of that, all of those decades of expertise and resources and, if you like, wisdom, were channeled into new cases, if you like, that were marginal to the overall international system. And the long-standing cases, which the EU, the UN had long withdrawn from, like Bosnia, were not reopened.
So I'm just going to introduce optimistic, because I think you're right, but what I do think is the new issues are corruption and crony capitalism, social justice and the environment. And there is a new generation that is really concerned with those issues. And I think they will produce a different set of politicians, but it will be a completely different way of thinking about peace issues. I mean, our focus was peace and human rights. Their focus is going to be social justice, anti-corruption, and green.
It's a bit state-centric, I don't think. I mean, I wonder whether it
will... No, but I don't think it will be addressed to the state. It will be addressed to the EU. It will be addressed to the UN. So it's not state-centric.
So the sustainable peace agenda is quite interesting because it's going over, in many ways, the political and the philosophical issues that it touches on. It talks about intergenerational sustainability. It brings in the problem of exclusionary dividing lines between humans and nature, between humans and humans. These are new terrains which engage with global justice. So it's not social justice. It doesn't necessarily depend on a centralized state authority in the way that minority rights, human rights, social justice might do conceptually. It's actually going beyond that. But the authority, and this is where the contradiction comes in with the sustaining peace agenda, the authority is going to be the UN General Assembly, you know, and its agencies, and maybe the Security Council if it gets its act together. But in practice, I think the authority is going to be in this digital terrain. It's going to be in the new polities that are formed in stage six. So that's why digital governmentality is already ahead of the game. I think they're already trying to govern the sustainable peace, even though it's still kind of empty shell, because in the next phase, when we have to wheel out a new systemic response to the new forms of war and violence, whether it's urban crime violence, neoliberal violence, the harnessing of the two with the state, and so on and so forth, you will need to have a peace agreement which has legitimacy with the people, which can be wheeled out and implemented. And they'll draw on that agenda, I think. They won't go back to the liberal peace. They won't go back to geopolitics, because those simply just don't have the legitimacy that we thought they once had. So yeah, I agree with you, but I think it might go further, Ian.
Okay.
Hi. I took an intro to law course here during the summer, and I'm originally from California. But I was wondering, with recently in the news, somebody in China invested in British Steel here, and how does that affect the stance that like Britain or the U.S. can have on things happening in, say, Hong Kong, which, you know, has been going on for 6 months, and it doesn't seem like it shouldn't be that they have to give up their rights that they're used to in a democratic process, but it doesn't seem like anybody who, like, they're seeking help from has the capacity to say anything.
And shall I take Elena's question as well? Elena?
Thank you. I got it. Okay, so I was listening to your talk, and I thought the idea of counterpeace is very interesting. But then I kept thinking, why do you call it international peace architecture when most of the things that we've talked about, or you've talked about, are basically international conflict management architecture? Not necessarily international, but including the liberal constitutional order, the way it was thought of, was a balance, right? it wasn't necessarily about peace, not the way we think of peace. And so then, if we think of it that way, obviously it will be counterpeace in and of itself. So that's a comment. But my question is actually related to something that you said now in the responses. You said something about the lack of political project or political alternative. And I'm wondering whether we're looking for it at the wrong places, whether the international, whatever that might mean, is the right place to look for. Because of the few places where I've known for peace, actual peace, to exist, have been pockets that are largely forgotten by the international, and maybe partially because of that. So I wonder what you think of in terms of the potential political project as an alternative, whether we might find that elsewhere rather than at the international level. Thanks.
Thanks. So on the question of giving up rights, I mean, just very quickly, I think the lesson of this architecture is you don't give up rights. You never give up rights. I mean, and the as Iran and others tell us, you know, Iran's rights do have a habit of expanding. And that's a problem for rights, because the more they expand, the more of a challenge they become. And the more of a challenge they become, the more the counter-revolution wakes up. So, you know, revolutionary processes always provoke opposition. So there's something going on here. I think by the time we get to stage four, the rights are getting so expansionary. You know, and if you look at the treaty system, I mean, all of those treaties, the 1960s, you know, right to use violence for self-determination, they're more or less dead letters. Because they've become such fundamental challenges. So that's the end of the online movement. You know, they've become such fundamental challenges to the dominant international framework. So what we see works in the development of the architecture is incremental change. Unfortunately, it's a very boring kind of conclusion. But anyway, you don't give up rights, you don't go back on rights, but you have to be aware that rights, as they say, carry responsibilities. But it's not responsibilities, actually. It's challenges to power. And that's the risk for rights. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing, a delayed reaction to the Hong Kong Constitution. And many other delayed reactions, too. I think, you know, for example, you could say that Brexit is all about unravelling the welfare state and getting back the, you know, feudal empires, and feudal estates in this country. You know, these things echo on over generations. That's why the architecture is intergenerational. That's why the archaeology stuff is so interesting, because it, too, is looking at the kind of big picture. I don't want to get too deterministic about things and too, you know, big picture, looking for the patterns in history and big data and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, there are some interesting lessons there. I think if we're rethinking, to go to Alan's question, you know, not just what is the alternative, but what tactics do we use to expand rights, to make sure that justice and sustainability are part of any peace agreement, or indeed of any political order for the future? So you're right, most of the layers of the architecture are of their time, and they were called variously in different ways, you know, management, resolution, transformation, peace building. I mean, these are sort of now long forgotten terminologies almost. And I think they all did do that thing of working out just how far they could push. I mean, that's why in the late 1950s, when you looked at news reporting on UN peacekeeping missions, it was like a celebrity. Peacekeeping is this amazing new invention that does this thing. That means we can stop wars without having the USSR and the Americans going to war with each other. You know, we don't have to make a decision on which ideology the peace agreement will be. We'll just stop the war, we'll freeze the conflict. It's incredible. You know, this kind of thing was going on. It's quite overt in some ways. But by the time we get to peace building in the liberal peace era and expanded rights era, we're digging really deep into politics, into social patterns and phenomena. It's also getting expensive. You know, and it's also changing the patterns of global politics in some way. From some corner being seen as neo-trusteeship type systems, therefore not very legitimate in local contexts, mission creep, overextending hegemonic militaries in the case of the US. Re-entering the great power terrain of politics, looking at Russia and the rise of India and China in particular, and the return of Russia, and these sorts of things. And an awful lot of what, you know, Russia seems to be railing against at the moment are those peace agreements of the 1990s. which creates a certain pattern of politics in the region. So the forgotten places thing, it's nice, and you know, I kind of like the idea and always have. And James Scott, in his work in the 1980s, was saying, oh, there are these amazing tribes in Indonesia, and they didn't like the state, it was oppressive, so they went off to live in the mountains, and all of these people, when they want to expand their rights, they go to live in the mountains, and they do things like they forget how to write, because writing is the instrument of law and the tool of oppression, and maybe they even change their language, because their language is nationalized, they forget their metaphors, and all that kind of stuff, forgotten places. But the question is, how do you scale it up? I mean, we live in a world where we have this architecture, we can't undo it. These things are already operating. These conflicts are already playing out. They're playing out over more than human lifetimes, which is why we need big institutions like the EU and the UN, the donor system, and many others to mitigate the imperfections of existing and older legacy institutions, and why we need new institutions to mitigate the deficiencies of those. So I kind of feel like it's a bit of an Orientalist myth in a way, you know, to go off and look for the forgotten place and then to learn the lesson you can scale up. The peaceful societies that never have conflict, although I can see why it's attractive. What I don't see, though, in those literatures, and you know, there are literatures about this, that's why anthropology became so big in IR, we like to do micro data stuff and all the rest of it. What I don't see is a political project, again. I mean, we live in a world where we inevitably have politics, we have scarce resources and people struggle over it. How do we manage that? How do we deal with it? Is there an optimum outcome? I'd go back to Plato again. We'll come back, sorry.
In and of itself, you don't have to scale it up. It's a political project by being decentralized, by being governing itself in a way.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean,
what they didn't know.
Up, we should scale down.
When they moved to their remote mountain islands in Indonesia, what they didn't realize was the world was coming for them. There's such a thing as interpenetration, and this is the world we live in now. And that's one of the interesting dynamics about, you know, the digital environment, isn't it? That much of what we think about politically is now not determined with the singular method of the nation or of the national state or even of the regional organization. I mean, where are the loyalties to these things? I think things don't seem to work in that way anymore, apart from amongst the, well, some generations who might still be dreaming of Brexit and those sorts of things. I don't know. Well, I don't know whether I can respond to that question properly, but I think that having been around that that thing myself, I find it problematic, but charming.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. I mean, you gave us so much food for thought. These thoughts are all sort of going into a book.
Yeah.
Yes, Peace in the 21st Century. And I wonder kind of how you know, these dilemmas, sort of this bifurcated, you know, trajectory that you charted, whether we'll have any clarity which way we are going. But thank you so much. And thank you for excellent questions. And watch for the program of events.